truth has legs. You know, it scampers around, and we fit it and we massage it to fit the narrative that we needed to fit in our life.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today, writer and actor Andrew McCarthy comes back on the show for a travel memoir lab episode. You might recall that these episodes are taken from the travel memoir workshops I host in Paris each year. These classes typically take place in July or August, though in this year, 2024, they'll be in September, so they won't compete with the Paris Olympics. More about those Paris writing classes, which take place each summer, can be found at pariswritingworkshops.com or check out the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. In this Travel Memoir Lab episode, Andrew tells my students about the universal importance of storytelling. One of his maxims is tell me a story, don't sell me a destination. And that philosophy came out of his work as an actor and TV director before he made the transition into travel writing. He talks about the role that dialogue plays in good travel stories, both in terms of advancing the story and creating breathing room on the page. He talks about what can be planned in advance when researching a travel story versus what can be left to serendipity, and how this is different for travel books and for travel articles. He talks about why stories about quests, be it for banana bread in Hawaii or black pearls in Tahiti, work so well in travel stories. Indeed, Andrew is chock full of travel writing tips in this episode, including how to braid the personal and the physical in a travel story and have those elements feed off of each other. He talks about the fallibility of memory and how remembering one aspect of an experience can affect how you remember or don't remember other aspects of that same experience. He talks about when it is and isn't fair to bend the truth a bit as a nonfiction writer, and how writers inevitably conflate certain details in an effort to tell a more satisfying story. He also talks about what and who to keep in a travel story versus what and who to leave out when you're writing it, and how to write about your family in an effective way. Hint, it's not really about them. Andrew zoomed us from Aspen, where he was reporting a travel story he alludes to a few times in the interview. My side of the conversation took place in a classroom in Paris, which means that my audio is a bit softer and more echoey than Andrew's is. Andrew starts by talking about his transition into travel writing and how he came to understand the act of writing himself onto the page was a way of seeing himself in a deeper and more profound way. Let's listen in. I'm glad you mentioned, tell me a story, don't sell me a destination, because it feels like that was a discovery fairly early in your career as a professional travel writer.
That is why I became a good travel writer, a successful travel, because I intuitively, inherently knew that because of coming from the acting world and directing world of like, you're always responsible to tell the story. So that's everything. And it's the beauty of that is you always have something to go back to. Wait, what's the story I'm telling? Okay, I'll go back to that, you know? And then it's just how you do that. But and then I just intuitively knew that because that's all I knew how to do, you know? But I got into travel writing because, Jesus, like how long's a piece of string? How far do we want to go back? But I started in 2004. But the reason I wanted to start travel writing was because I walked the Camino de Santiago back in 1990-something, mid-90s. And it was a trip that changed my life. And the Camino de Santiago, for those of you who don't know, quickly is 500-mile pilgrimage route across the north of Spain. And it's about a month walk. And it's an amazing journey. And I did that. I read about it. I just something in it said, I got to do that. And I went and did it. Impulsively, like a week later after I read about it. And it changed my life because in a nutshell, it helped me, it revealed to me how much fear had dominated my life. And which seems odd, I suppose, since I was an actor and out in the public world and successful and sort of out there. But it dawned on me how much fear called all the shots in my life. And in discovering that, you know, we're not liberated from these things the minute we discover them, but it lost the almighty power, the unconscious power it had over me. So from then on going forward, I knew, oh, that's fear talking. And I made a decision I would not let fear stop me in my life. And so that was really profound for me. It was changing, life-changing. And because that happened while I was on the road, I just kept traveling. Every time I wasn't working, I'd just get on a plane and go somewhere. And far away from home, I read a lot of Paul Theroux's travel books, and his books changed my life. His idea of go far, go alone, get out of touch, don't come back for a long time, really resonated with me. And so I did that. And I started writing while I was on the road because I was lonely, and I tried to keep a journal, but I was a terrible journal keeper because everything was just like, oh, I'm so lonely. The food's bad. I want to, you know, and so I was bad. I was a self-pitying journal keeper. So I was walking down the road in Saigon one day alone, and this kid pulled up next to me on his scooter, and he said, hop on, I'll give you a ride. I was like, leave me alone. He said, no, I'll give you a ride. Leave me alone. And he wouldn't leave me alone. So eventually I just hopped on his scooter and he drove me all around Saigon for the day. And we spent the day together and he took me all over, and like nothing that was in the, you know, Lonely Planet, just like where his father had gotten arrested, where his mother tended the gardens, public gardens and stuff. And it was a fascinating day. And when I got back to my room at the end of the day, you know, I gave him 10 bucks and he was thrilled and I was thrilled. And I went up to my room and I was so jazzed. I didn't know what to do. I was just pacing around. I was so excited, sort of. And so I grabbed a piece of paper and I had a pencil, and I never wrote anything in my life. I didn't write in high school. I didn't read in high school. I didn't do any. It wasn't part of my life. I just wrote down what happened. You know, I'm an actor, so I know bad dialogue. I've said so much bad dialogue. I know good dialogue when I hear it. So I wrote down things he said, and helped me realize instantly how dialogue sets place, creates character, propels story, and immerses you very quickly in a story. And it looks great on page. You know, having all that negative space looks great, as opposed to just relentless paragraphs that seem impenetrable. Dialogue viscerally, besides, yeah, people talk about all those other things about dialogue, but one thing dialogue really does on the page is creates breath and space for the readers. They go, ah, you know? And that's ultimately what we're trying to do when we travel write, isn't it? Just create space and make you go, I want, yes, you know? Anyway, I digress. But anyway, so I wrote that down. I wrote down the story of what happened during our day. And the instant I finished it, I just went, oh my God, there I am. I just felt like me. I felt like me. It was the same way I felt when I acted for the first time when I was 15 years old, walked out on the stage in high school as the Artful Dodger. I just felt like me. And I said, oh, it was just a revelation to me. So I kept writing, doing that as I traveled. And I had no ambition to be a traveler, you know, to do publicly. And so I did that for years, like 7, 8 years, just giving these books full of stories that I wrote. And one day I did have an ambition. So I met an editor and through a friend of a friend. And I said, you should let me write for your magazine. And he said, you're an actor, dude. And I said, yeah, but I can tell a story. That's what I do for a living. And he thought that was a good answer. So he like gave me a chance. And then it kind of took off, and it took off quickly. And it took off for two reasons. One, I've already said, is because I knew, just tell me a story, suck me in, don't sell me anything. And the other was underneath it, I knew, and I never really wrote about this, but travel changed my life. It made my life better. It made me at home in myself, being out in the world. Travel changed my life, and it can change yours. And that was sort of underneath the energy and excitement underneath everything I wrote. And it still is. When I'm writing well. You know, I made a point early on of thinking of not telling anybody I was the Brat Pack actor, because you send email, you send pitches to people by email. Nobody knows who the hell you are. And so I would study magazines, see what kind of stories they did. You know, I didn't pitch somebody China if they did China last month, you know, and I studied what kind of stuff they did. And I wrote pitches geared to them. And I wrote good pitches, which are always very provocative. In the first sentence was always provocative, and the hook is provocative, so that they keep reading the email, you know? And I started getting stories. And I knew that once I was outed as being the Brat Pack actor, oh, he thinks he's a writer. You know, by then I'd written for The Atlantic, The New York Times, National Geographic Traveler. I'd written for these good magazines. So in my particular case, that was something that was really conscious, to make sure to write for pedigree places, because I know people are going to think I'm some interloper who thinks he's a writer, and oh my God, what a bore. But then they kind of go, oh, the actor thinks, oh, well, you know, he's written for The Atlantic and The Times, and that's you. And maybe we should actually look at this. So anyway, and it just took off from there. And, you know, like I said, I won that award, and a new award. People think you're genius. And I was in the game. And, you know, and I also did it for fun and for free. I never anticipated making any kind of living at it. Same way I started acting. I did it because I loved it. If you want a job and you're doing it so you can travel the world, I don't think you'll do very well. If you love it, and you love, you know, then great. Anything, I would say that to anything. So I'm not a good business person, but I mean, I did it solely. It's not a very good business model to go from being a movie star to being a writer for $2 a word. I mean, that's, you know, what's the trajectory there, you know, but I loved it. So, and it was the same thing to me as acting and directing. It just touched me. I felt like me when I did it, you know, and there was, and the, it, I guess the things that overlap is that they're both storytelling, but I just felt like me when I did them because it made me feel like I was inhabiting myself. And I think that really shows. So anyway, I rant on, but that's how I got started and how it happened. And can I give an example of storytelling that Ralph, would that be okay?
Please do.
My wife wanted to go to, and I love this story because it's really true. My wife wanted to go, she said, get a story in Tahiti. I want to go on vacation to Tahiti. And I'm like, okay. I can't call up my editor at Nat Geo and say, hey, Keith, my wife wants to go to Tahiti. Huh? You know, oh, that sounds great, Andy. Bring me back 3,000 words, you know. So that's not going to happen. So I looked on the internet, and in about 5 minutes, you discover that once you get it past the overwater bungalows, you discover that 95% of the world's black pearls are farmed in Tahiti. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. So around then, my mother had a birthday, and I said, Mom, do you like pearls? She said, yes, dear, pearls are lovely. And so I called my editor, or I wrote down this pitch to my editor. I said, you know, my mother has a big birthday coming up. And when she asked me what she wanted, she got a faraway look in her eye. And she said, you know, Andrew, dear, I once remember seeing a single black pearl hanging from a strand. I've never forgotten it. So, Keith, good editor that I am, good writer, son, good son that I am, I'm going to not go down to Tiffany. I'm going to get on a plane. I'm going to fly halfway around the world to the remote Tuamotu Archipelago. I'm going to find a pearl farmer who's going to let me dive down 10 meters under the sea, yank the oyster from the bed, bring it up, slice it open, and pluck my mother's pearl dripping wet from the sea and bring it on home for her birthday. And, you know, they couldn't get me on the plane fast enough to write that, you know, and it's just, and it's all, it's story, 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 you know, and Tahiti got sold. They bought advertising in the magazine. You know, my wife got a vacation. My mother got a pearl, which I've never seen her wear ever. But anyway, and to that, to just finish that, I will never make something up whole cloth, but if I see something, I'll never do that. Because it has that ring of truth to me. I can't write it well. I'm not as good enough writer. If it doesn't have truth in it to me, I can't write it. But I will if I see an eagle fly over there, just quick glimpse of an eagle, and then there was something on this thing over there. I will conflate things sometimes to, you know, like my mother didn't say that about the pearl, you know, but she said, yeah, I like pearls. Like, okay, it's good enough for me. And she did have a birthday coming up. And, you know, so there's your storytelling. And as long as I can feel I'm telling the truth and it has a little, you know, pizzazz in it, that's okay too in my book. but I am adamant and like, I got to go there. Got to go look at the thing. It may not be as what I thought it would be, but I can paint. I go, oh, this will write up well. You know, I went to a concert yesterday here in Aspen because I hadn't in this big tent they have, and it was this orchestra, and I'm not sophisticated enough to love Mahler, but you know, it was an interesting thing, and it'll write up well. You know what I mean? Oh, there's 150 words on that that'll write up well. And so I just, you know, and you find details in it that are good. You know, I guess you're always talking, you know, I'm sure you're talking about, you know, the micro and the macro of storytelling of, you know, what your detail, 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 and then pulling back and getting the bigger picture. And then, you know, it's your focus. It's like camera lenses. You're zooming in on certain things, little inserts, and then you're pulling back to tell the whole thing and how that little thing mirrors the big thing, you know, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, I ramble.
Have you found the concrete version of your Aspen story? You have this conceptual one. You have the concept of Aspen as this counterintuitive place that's strangely good for the 1% to go right now. Did you have a sense for the concrete stuff before you came, or are you finding that through Mahler stories and walking the streets and talking to people?
So I don't know. I just sort of came with concept. But on that note, the longer I've done it, the more I've begun to sort of trust myself to find it when I'm there. But like, I didn't fly to Tahiti until I had a pearl farmer who was going to let me do that. I knew where that story was ending before I got on a plane. You know, I didn't go there and hope I find it. You know, I don't know if you've talked to our great friend, Don George. Don is like Mr. Serendipity. He just like goes and just experiences. And I'm like, That's great, Dom, but I can't do that. I got to know that I got to meet a farmer who's going to let me dive down and do that. I'm not getting on a plane. You know, particularly if you do quest stories, which are often very effective stories. They work really well. And I've written a lot of them. It's unless you're writing the snow leopard or something, you know, people who never got to see the leopard, but it was more of an existential thing. It's good to know you're going to find what you're looking for on a quest story. Like, I've written the quest story about finding the best banana bread in Hawaii. And I've written the exact same story about finding the best soda bread in Ireland, you know, both for Bon Appetit, you know, with different editors. But I knew where those stories were going to end before I started them, you know. And I would say I always start with certain tent poles of things for a big story, certain tent pole ideas and places, things I'm going to put in the story. And then so 40% of my story, I know what it's going to be before I get on a plane. I know I'm going to go interview that guy, and I know that's I'm going to go to that place. I, you know, and 60% kind of is, happens on the ground. But as long as I know I have scaffolding, then I'm relaxed enough to sort of be serendipitous, like our friend Don George. If I don't, I'll sometimes feel tense and not be able to see the story, you know. But as long as I know the scaffolding of it, if that makes any sense, And again, the longer I've done it, the more I feel like, oh, I'll find it, you know. But I think it's really important to, you know what story you want to tell before you go out and start telling it. You know, that's why writing for like places like Nat Geo, they want a really specific pitch, where which is it's a real pain in the butt to do before you're gone somewhere, but you have to do the research. But like Travel and Leisure would just be like, yeah, Tahiti, bring us back some Tahiti, which is great on assignment. But then you get there and you go, what the f- am I going to write about Tahiti? You know? So anyway, I always find it helps to know a bit of, you know, what story am I going there to tell? Like I pitched a while back a story of my wife got me addicted to tea. I never used to drink tea. She's from Ireland. She got me addicted to tea. I said, let's go do a story about looking for the perfect cup of tea in China. And the editor said, I like that, but I just did China. I said, let's go looking for the perfect cup of tea in Darjeeling, India. He said, good, go do it. You know what I mean? The story is exactly the same. This location was, you know?
So you just published Walking with Sam, which is about walking the Camino. And I'm curious to know about the serendipity versus knowing the story axis with the book length project. Were there moments when you were walking with your son and you're thinking, oh my God, I don't think there's a book here? Did you sort of have a few things in your back pocket that you thought maybe if this happens or if I sort of create this scenario, it's more likely to be narrative? Or did you Don George your way into Walking with Sam and just let serendipity be your guide?
Well, that was a little different in the sense that I'd walked it 25 years earlier, so I knew there was a then and now aspect. And I knew, and in writing these kind of things, you know, it's always about, as Paul Theroux said, it's always about the traveler and never the destination. And I knew walking the same thing, the route that I'd walked 25 years earlier, there was going to be a mirror held up to my life and my experience of my life. And, you know, you're writing travel memoir in that case, and which is an interesting thing always to try and thread and braid the personal and the physical, you know, and the journey of that, in that particular case, a journey, a physical linear journey, you know, and that's the key in my experience of writing good travel memoirs, threading and having one feed off to the other, you know, in the middle of that. And I will answer your question, I think, Ralph, but like in the middle of that, I saw a bird, an osprey, or it reminded me of an osprey if it wasn't. And as a kid growing up, we had a picture of an osprey in a painting in our house. And it became a big deal. You know, I wanted it when I went to college. My father had a fit about it. And it became this big family trauma, just about this one painting. And so when I saw the osprey walking across Spain, that allowed the triggering of that memory of my youth and my childhood to come in. This is a literal example, but that allowed me to then digress for a couple pages into this traumatic sort of life-altering little event that happened in my life. And then a good segue, we may be back to the walk, you know, because I was writing a book about walking with my sons, and naturally it had to be about my father as well, the legacy of, you know, handing things down. And I'm walking this route, so I'm then handing it off to my son to walk the route, you know, and legacy of fathers and sons. So I thought that story would be useful in that kind of thing. But that to me is always the thing. How do we braid these things through. And you've really got to create the physical. And how does it mirror the emotional and the internal? Or juxtapose it. But with that book, I knew I'd have at least holding up a mirror to myself, because these books are always about self. Even though I say it's about walking with my son, it's really about my experience of parenting, because it's also none of my business. It's not a tell-all about my kid. It's about my experience of parenting. You know, my son says to me, I'm jealous. He's jealous. So that allows me to then tell the story of how I got terribly jealous, you know, of my wife on our honeymoon and, you know, that kind of, so that illuminates character in me. And, you know, and when I really knew I had a book in that particular instance was, as you walk to Santiago, it's 500 miles to Santiago, which is a city about 50 miles from the coast. And many people continue on to Finisterre, which is called the ocean, end of land. And I always didn't. I go to the pilgrimage in Santiago, that's where I'm finishing. But a lot of people go to Finisterre. And my son halfway through said, Dad, I'm going to go to Finisterre. And I, in that instant, I go, oh, I've got a book. Because the book is about fathers and sons and legacy. And we all, as parents and fathers, and any parents, want our children to succeed and go beyond what we've done, right? I think that's hardwired into us as parents. So the idea that my son was literally going to go beyond what I'd accomplished made me realize, oh, that ties in the emotional and into the physical and braids that right through to the end. And so I get to Santiago, I sit my tired ass down, and my son continues on doing more than I did. And, you know, and then to me, that really worked. And literally in that instant, I go, oh, I've got a book. Yeah, you go to Finisterre, Sam. You go to Finisterre. Don't change your mind. So anyway, that's how that worked. And I also knew, had the advantage of knowing the Camino is something that just, it asserts itself into your life. It teaches you what you're supposed to learn. I don't know, there's some magic thing that happens on the Camino. So I knew that that would happen. I trusted. So it had a little Don George serendipity, but I knew. And I'm good. I don't have much imagination, I don't think. I'm good at telling a linear story, you know, which people always tease me for it. Oh, you know, I write about two things. One thing, really, finding home all the time and succeeding in a quest, you know, which is the same thing, really. My wife always jokes, she goes, oh, you didn't find home again, did you? And, you know, yes is the answer, you know. And so anyway, I don't know if that answers any of that.
No, that's good. Actually, it's interesting. The Camino, a place that I've never been, I met a reader wanted to meet me in Paris before the first class I taught here. This is the second one. He had planned a round the world trip for a year, and he was going to start by walking the Camino. He found so much peace on the Camino, he wasn't sure if he wanted to finish his 1 year trip. He thought that after 6 weeks of walking across Spain, being in Barcelona or Paris seemed superficial. Hanging out at a surf camp in a hostel didn't seem as central to him as what he felt when he was on the trail. So there's something, not that everybody does that, but it felt like there's something special about that place, that communitas. And one thing, I know that you met a guy who kept driving ahead. Like there was this traveling community, and one of the guys kept catching a taxi to the next town.
Yeah,
the roundabout way of saying, what was the community like during your communitas, and how did you decide to integrate them into the story about you and your son?
Well, it's part of the Camino. You do find these little pods that you walk with because people are walking about the same pace as you. So you gravitate to these little pods eventually. So that is part of the Camino experience. And I assumed that would have happened to me the first time I walked. And it was interesting. The timing was interesting. On both times, we walked alone, and I walked alone when I did it the first time for about 2 weeks, just insular, and then sort of branched out. It broadened out into a community for the last couple of weeks. But, you know, adding character and creating character in these things is essential. You know, it's all about creating the context and texture, and, you know, adding characters is great because they also reflect back on you if you're writing memoir, you know, and you just, you know, characters are great. And so this guy who took a taxi cab, Roger, we labeled him, or my son did. What I guess I got good at, when you hear it, bing, that's it. Taxi cab Roger, taxi cab Roger. Okay, I've got Roger's thread. The minute my son called him Taxi Roger, I just, okay, that Roger's going to be in it. He's going to be showing up every week, every day in a taxi, which he did. But I mean, he might not have been that more peripheral than he was, but and then it turns into something about what is he looking for? Why is he doing that? You know, but so adding characters is essential, you know, to the life and to storytelling. And they're funny, you know, if you can be funny. I'm just reading Bill Bryson's book about his book called A Short History of Nearly Everything, which is not a travel book, but he's a wonderful travel writer. And his books, he writes so funny. If you can write funny, boy, have you got it made. You know, I can't write funny, but when the people that can, what a gift. And, you know, but somebody like Taxi Cab Roger, the minute you mention him, you even say his name, it's like you smile and it's just like, oh my God. And so it just adds texture. And, you know, particularly if you're writing a linear story like I am, you want, you know, you need texture so it doesn't get monotonous and episodic. I'm always challenged by just not having it become episodic. You know, it has to be gathering. It has to always be gathering. What's the story? Is this gathering toward the story? It may be a cool little incident, but if it's just an episodic aside, it's out. It has to serve the story. It has to be doing a couple things at once, you know? It has to be interesting and driving the narrative forward.
It sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like as you're traveling, be it on the Camino or in Tahiti, you are looking at the landscape, but you're also looking at the storyscape, that you're always on the lookout for details that can feed the story.
Absolutely. Yeah. Always what you're thinking.
Yeah.
Oh, story, 24/7. When I'm writing for magazines, I'll never pull out my pad and tell people I'm writing a story for them, magazines. You know, I would always just talk to them, get the quote and run to the bathroom and write down all the stuff. And, you know, I've been with people where I've gone to the bathroom 3-4 times. They must think I have some kind of, you know, prostate issues or something. So, you know, the minute you pull out the pad and go, I'm from Nat Geo, everybody, they either clam up or they become an authority. Well, you know, that mountain, and it's just, no. So I rarely, never tell someone, well, I'm, you know, at the end, sometimes I'll need to get their email and whatever so that the fact checker can check it. But, and at the end, I go, you know, I'm writing a story. Would you said something that's good. Do you mind if I get your emails for you if somebody wants to contact you about that? And they're like, oh, yeah, sure. But I always travel. And, you know, when for the book, you know, I didn't tell people I was writing a book. You know, we're just walking.
This is an aside question, but do your two worlds overlap? Do you ever run into a guy from Chile who's a big fan of Less Than Zero and is wondering why you're there?
Yeah. I mean, walking across, you know, I used to hide from that. And now I just sort of, it's part of my story. So I just plug it right in on the Camino. It's in the book about some girl who wanted to take a Weekend at Bernie's picture of, like, you know, imitating the poster, you know, holding up the dead guy. And it's like, gee, I haven't done that 1,000 times. Okay, sure. You know, and, you know, and then how does that feed what's happening between me and Sam, though, too? Then plugging it in, not just so have it's in this, so it's a vanity aside. How is that plug in? You know, and you always find, and you know, you can shoehorn massage these things to fit when you need to. But again, that's just keeping an eye on the story of, you know, me feeling, you know, that within that instance, like me feeling sort of slightly separate from other people, which is a tendency I can have anyway. For example, you know, and then me taking this picture, oh, I'm different than the other people, or think I am, or whatever, you know. So that's how that shoehorn, you know, slid into that narrative. But I also, you know, I can be a pretty solitary person, and I would often, if I wasn't, one of the great things about travel writing is it forces me to interact with people in a way I probably wouldn't in real life. I could go somewhere for a week and never talk to anybody and have a great time. But when you're travel writing, you need quotes. You got to interact with people. So it's forced that to happen. It forces that. Because you need quotes. You need quotes. And do not get quotes from your taxi driver.
Listen to
okay?
them.
Okay. The minute somebody says, and my taxi driver, like, next. No, engage with people. You know? And don't start, I'm sorry to tell you, but don't talk about looking out the window in Ireland and seeing the checkerboard green landscape below. Oh, my God. Next. Those are two of my pet peeves. I mean, yeah.
There's
immersion. It's not like, you know, talking to your taxi driver is not immersive. Like yesterday, coming in from the airport, I got a great quote from my taxi driver about exactly what my story was going to be, about how people aren't here this year. I'm like, damn, how can I make this guy not the taxi driver? You know, maybe I'll run into him in a bar somewhere and then I can use it. If I ran into him on the street, I could use the quote he gave me in the taxi thing, but I can't use it as, you know, if I never run into him again.
Well, if he was your Uber driver, he might have like six other jobs. So you just name one of those other jobs.
Exactly. But, you know, you could do that. You know, that I guess I'm okay with, on a, you know, in a pinch.
Right. As I was meeting the grocery clerk, who also happened to be my Uber driver.
Well, I would leave that part out. I said in the supermarket, I mean, even in the supermarket, they're talking about how, you know, there's no checkout line this year. My guy at the register said to me, you know, that's kind of okay. That's interesting. That's real detail because everybody goes to the supermarket. So suddenly, instantly, you have identification and relatability.
I'm curious, in craft, you said that traveling wasn't, or I'm sorry, storytelling is an instinctual thing, going back to acting. It's sort of a bones deep part of, you know, taking on a character. I know that you're at NYU, did they teach story craft when you were studying acting, or have you studied?
In acting, though, in acting, you're not really telling the story. You're not responsible for the story in acting. You're responsible only for your facet. And directing is where I learned that, really. Because in directing, you're responsible for, you know, I'm a TV director throughout my other life. And so that's where you're responsible for telling the story. You know, and you start, and you know, you do it in through detail and through, you know, you make sure you get a wide shot of the whole room. Make sure you set the furniture. It's always like, set the furniture. Where is Tahiti? You know, you always start, you know, I always start with the hook, get him in, and then back out. Tahiti is a string of islands in the South Pacific, then this island, blah, blah, blah. You know, but start with an incident, an inciting incident, right? That has a good little, that's brief as you can make it. And then I pull back and tell the nut graph, right? And, you know, where what I'm here to do. Tahiti are these islands, and I came here to get my mother's pearl. And then, you know, several chapters on examples of that quest. And then at the end, hopefully you come right back to the beginning. I think the Tahiti story started with, and I burst through the surface gasping for air. It's like, oh, where are you? What's happening? Details, specifics, my God. Everybody knows what it's like to need air and burst through the surface of the water. What's happening? What's he doing? And then I back, I'm in Tahiti to do a string of islands in the South Pacific to write this, to find a pearl for my mother for her birthday.
Set the furniture. I call that signposting. Set the
furniture. I always call it set the furniture. Just where's the room? Where am I? What's going on? Because if you don't know that, if you do the whole scene in close-up, you don't know where the fuck you are. You know, you have to, you're travel writing, so you have to set the scene.
Yeah.
Let me see. And then TV directing, and any kind of directing, it's like you can start in a close-up. I often love to start in a provocation, in an insert of someone picking up a phone or picking up a coin off thing, just a small detail. So you're suddenly leaning as a viewer and as a reader, you're leaning in. Like, what's going on? Where am I? Oh, and then you pull back and you go, oh, I'm here. Okay, cool.
So there's a directing element to it.
That's how I'm a very visual person, and that's how I approach it, you know. Yeah. You know, I'm responsible for telling you this story. And that's how I did that, because that's what I've done for so many years. So I don't know how other people do it. That's just how I do it, because that makes, I'm a visual person. So I see everything as sort of a movie anyway. And maybe that, I think that predated acting, but that's how I experience, you know, things. That's, I'm a visual learner. I'm not an auditory person or anything, you know?
Yeah. Well, I have one more question based on what you just talked about. Then I'm going to open it up to people in the room. And also people on Zoom. I can't see the people on Zoom, so I'm going to start with the questions that might be in the room. But way back in the, early in the conversation, you said that I was a terrible journal keeper. Have you become a better travel journal keeper? And what is your relationship to your personal notes and just sort of the details that you record for yourself as you travel?
I never journal. I never journal. And I don't keep them. I keep notes for, you know, when I'm doing a story in a little Moleskine, you know, one of those little books. But I just don't. And, you know, on that note, on the notes that I do take are always either quotes or detail specific things. You know I can get the facts online, you know. Yeah. I just write down quotes and experiential details. Or I'll when I'm writing memoir, I'll write down something as I'm, you know, because everything I wrote in, I took eight or nine little of those Moleskine books across Spain I filled up. And it was all just bird reminds me of dad's story painting. And so I know when I get home, you know, we were walking across this town and I see, going back to that story I told earlier, you know, I'll just write that in my notebook. And That's all I need, you know, and I know because that's where it happened. That's where it's going to fit in the narrative. And, you know, I do think you have the luxury in the narrative. If that bird story fits better later or earlier, that's fine, too. You know, you can massage that. If I'm not ready to tell that story about my dad's anger and volatility so early in the book and I want to save it for later in the book, I'll take that bird and put it later in the book, you know, if it need be. In this case, it stayed right where it was, but I'm okay with that kind of, because it did happen. It did trigger that emotional thing. And so, you know, there's emotional truth in it. So I'm fine with that.
Yeah, no, there's interesting. That's interesting to hear. I think sometimes as we approach nonfiction, we're curious about the rules between what we're permitted to move around versus what we can. I mean, obviously travel writers are not hard journalists. Do you have a line you don't cross as far as moving details or?
Yeah, no, just that. I can't make it up. I have to have seen that eagle. I can, you know, embellish, you know, talk a little bit about more of that eagle, but if I didn't see him out of the corner of my eye, at least I can't talk about him swooping down low. Right. You know, that's my thing. I have to, you know, because I, like I said, it doesn't have any truth to me. I can't write it. But I, you know, you can, and I generally try and say as hard as you can to, it happened on this day. And I go, oh, it fits better there. But wait, why did it happen on this day? And if you dig a little deeper and stick to the truth, as long as the hard truth of that, as long as it belongs there because of that. And it forces me to dig a little deeper emotionally. That's more of a more value than where it's more convenient. You know, and I rarely do that. I usually stick to it because if it doesn't feel like it's fitting, I have to really then, why isn't it fitting? Because that's where it happened. So that's where it's real and that's where it's authentic and that's where emotionally is the truth. But why? So I need to dig deeper to find out why it fits there. And in the first draft, I'll just leave it there clunky and leave it there, you know, and figure it out. And often, you know, you come back. You know, often when you write these memoir of the travel memoir, you always, you know, the first one I wrote, well, The Longest Way Home, I spent so much time on the first paragraph, first chapter. And finally, someone said, you're going to rewrite the whole first chapter when you get to the end. Just keep going. You know, and it's true every time. I've always rewritten the first chapter entirely once I got to the end. So don't, I would, if I was not getting lost in making that first chapter so great so you could move on. Because my experience is I always went back and redid it. Once I knew more, you think where it's going. I knew I was going to end in Santiago. I knew my son was going to finish there. And yet still, it was changed at the beginning. Because you realize, oh, this is what the story needs to set up. They're different than what I thought it needed to set up. It's like traveling, right? You think you're going to do one thing, and then the trip reveals something else to you. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, you know, the trip you were planning is gone. The trip you're on presents itself. It's the same way in my experience with travel memoir writing.
Questions for Andrew from the room. If you have a question, actually, you're in a good position, Aaron, because you're close to the computer.
Hi, thank you for joining our class. I had a question. You still do a lot of, you direct and work in film and TV and everything with your travel writing career. How do you, like, time-wise balance two different projects like that? Do you take chunks of time and devote it to travel writing? Do you mix it up within your daily life with all you do in TV, etc.? How does that?
I don't know. I don't even know. You just sort of do as a, you know. There's no order or plan here, and never has been. So I just sort of feel it away. And oh, I've got time for that. Oh, I can do that. You know, it's just kind of juggling, and it's all kind of the same thing to me. But I don't really know. There's no plan of that. It's just if I've got time, I've got a week here. Oh, let's go do this. I'll go do this story. You know. So there's no. You know, TV directing sort of swallows you whole. It's like falling down a rabbit hole. You don't really have much time for anything else when you're doing it. But I like to have a couple different things in various stages along the way so you don't just finish, okay, now what am I going to do? So I like to have a few prongs out there at the time. But there's no real plan. A smarter person would have one.
It sounds like maybe the writing is just naturally more flexible because I've approached you for podcast interviews, and when you're acting or directing a TV season, it's sort of that sort of off limits.
Well, your time's not your own, you know, when you're doing that, and it bought you, and fair enough. And but I also, you know, I really do write everything for fun and for free. I write for me, you know. I like as few votes. The older I've gotten, too, I like as few votes as possible in my life. And then writing's the only thing where there are no votes here. My vote is the only, like, good or bad, you know, my vote's the only one that's being heard here. You know, so I like that. Whereas in acting and in directing things, there are a lot of, you know, cooks in the kitchen, which is that how that works, which is fine and great. But at a certain point, I'd rather sit alone in a room.
I was just curious if you find your writing is morphing from travel writing to something else. And do you see yourself as a different kind of writer? Would you write just a memoir? Oh, you have wrote a memoir. You wrote about race, which is a little bit.
Well, I was when I started writing, I had a mentor basically called Keith Bellows, who's an editor at National Geographic Traveler. And he really helped me a lot. And he said, don't be a travel writer, be a writer who travels. And I've tried to stay to that. You know, I wrote a novel, a young adult novel that and I did write the memoir, just a pure memoir that Rolf just mentioned. But I find I enjoy the travel world. And you sort of like that's kind of in my mind. Are these books travel memoirs, or are they just travel books, or are they memoirs? I don't know. I kind of, the longer and more of them I do, I kind of just think of them as travel books. And, you know, the message, whatever, the identification, I sneak in there. Because all you really want, no matter what, is to get the reader. And what I'm always after is just get the reader nodding their head going, yeah, oh, I feel that way. Yeah, I know exactly what that feels like. And then you have connection, and then that's what you want. You want connection, and then people feel less alone, right? And that's what sort of you're after. So I'm always after, you know, Joseph Conrad, great writer, said, you know, my goal is to make people see. And I think that's what you make them see on the page. And I can do that best through travel writing. I'm most successful at, and I'm not good enough, I guess. I'm most successful at creating place. And then the emotion can kind of, you know, make them see where you are, and then they can easier see the emotion that you're having and trying to communicate. So I find for me, because I love travel so much, that's where the fit is. So I don't know what they're, whether they're travel books or whether they're memoirs. Doesn't really matter to me. They sell them as memoirs because travel books don't sell as much. So, and I do write what I have to offer is, you know, if you're going to ask somebody to read, commit to reading something, a book, you know, you have to make yourself available on the page in a very real way. You're not just telling stories. That gets pretty boring. You know, if you're not going to create something and come clean on the page, people, you're asking them to invest their time and whatever, and you need to create something, offer that they can kind of go, yeah, I feel that way. Jesus, I didn't know anybody else felt like that. Yeah, that's, oh, cool. Okay, you know what I mean? And just go, yeah, 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 my son, that's how, oh my God, my kid does that too. Jesus, I thought I was the only one. You know, that's all you want, and then you've got them. You know, then you've got them. And they'll follow you to Santiago. But if you're just telling about the place, in my opinion, it's just not that interesting, ultimately. Unless you're really interested in what that trail was like, it's not that interesting. So you just want to, in that instance, I want to make it feel like you're walking beside me, talking to me, and I'm having an honest, candid conversation. And in walking, you know, walking and talking, things, you know, when you, it all comes out when you're walking, you know, so, because that's what walking does. It's so, I think you have to come clean. And, you know, you write to find out what's a Joan Didion line. I write to find out what I'm thinking or something. I kind of write to find out what I'm feeling about things, for sure. And you want to be rigorous in that. You know, whenever I get early reads on my books, and people always go, oh, yeah, I really love it. I just want a little more here. I want a little more here. I'm like, oh, you want more? Fuck, I want more there. Okay, my dad, you know, and, you know, that. But that's always my early reads, always kind of go, yeah, I really enjoy it. I want more of that. And it's always the emotion they want, because they want to be able to relate and identify.
Was your straight memoir a different monster creatively than your travel memoirs? You've written one book of fiction and then two travel books and one straight memoir. Was
You know, I told good stories, and I know people are going to love this story. I go, yeah, but what was going on underneath? I'm like, oh, but I just told you this cool story about St. Elmo's Fire. Who cares? And like, no, and what was really going on? You know, yeah, it's the same thing. But, you know, you have to be careful. My experience is, because I learned this you have to really be rigorous, because once you write it down, that's what happened. Huh. Once you write something down, that's what happened. And that's the truth. So you have to really be, because there's something in the act of doing that, that's what I think happened now, you know? And so you have to be pretty rigorous with that. That's just an interesting, and I've talked to other people who've written, and they go, yeah, that's exactly right. That's once you've written, once it's on paper, something powerful about that. That's history. That's what happened. Don't you find that, Rolf?
Oh, I do. And sometimes even in my own memory, I mean, you're talking.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That, and actually, I think Susan Sontag wrote about this, that like in the context of photography, it was Annie Dillard, that once a photograph is taken, then you start to remember photographically, you start to remember the details that were inside the frame of that photo. Similarly, you write a story, like there's stories from Marco Polo, Didn't Go There, that I now remember in terms of the story that's on the page. And a lot of those five senses memories are fading away because I chose whatever sensory information went into those when I was writing for Don George 20 years ago. And I think you're right.
Yeah, I think absolutely. You know, I was trying to make a movie years ago about a boating accident that happened. And it was an article from the New Yorker, and I bought it, and I was interested in doing this as a father-son thing. And they got caught in a storm, and the storm was the metaphor for the relationship, and thought it would be a good movie. So I went and I talked to the son, both of them, father and the son. And the son told me verbatim what happened with the article. He basically repeated the article back to me. And then at the end of the end, I was like, God, I didn't get anything out of this. And at the end, because, you know, I reread the article, you know, as I knew you were coming to talk to me. So I reread the article. And I was like, oh, that's what happened. Mm. Whereas the father hadn't read the article ever. And he told me an entirely different, it was like two different recollections, two different stories that happened. So that was interesting. I just think, and the son wasn't withholding from me. He just, that's what his experience now is, what's on that page. You know, I just think that's an interesting thing to know. So which makes one want to be more rigorous and go deeper. And, you know, but in particular with like writing the memoir, I told those, you know, stories of what happened back in the day so many times. It's like the truth is long gone. You know, memory is so fallible and so subjective, and the truth is long gone. You know, and to think that this is what happened is, I think we're being a bit disingenuous or naive about ourselves to think this is what happened. In many cases, not always, of course. And I think that's worth knowing and acknowledging that, like, you know, the truth is, I was asked to do a movie once years ago, and Claude Chabrol, this great French director, since you're in Paris, he wanted me to play Henry Miller, who was like 38 or something at the time of the movie, and I was 27 or something. And I said, Mr. Chabrol, I'm way too young for this character. And he said, my dear boy, the truth today is not the truth tomorrow. And I had no idea what he meant by that. I just thought it was so French. But as I've gotten older, I realized that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. The truth has legs. You know, it scampers around. And we fit it, and we massage it to fit the narrative that we needed to fit in our life. You know? So anyway, that's my perception of things. I wrote in that memoir, for an example of this, I guess this is off topic, but I mean, I remember where I was and I heard John Lennon died. And it was... And I remember it so clearly. I always heard it on the radio, on WNEW radio, where I listened to this one DJ every night, and I heard it at 10 o'clock at night that John Lennon has just been shot. And I'd swear it was this DJ called Allison Steele. And so I wrote that, and I wrote the whole exact, and I would swear on my children's life, this is what happened. And I said, well, I should just fact check this, do a little due diligence. And I fact checked it. And in about a minute and a half, I saw that it wasn't Allison Steele, the Nightbird, who was the DJ then. She'd stopped being a DJ the year before. And it was a guy named, you know, Vin Scelsa. And I listened to the audio of it. I then went to YouTube and got the audio of it, him saying how John Lennon had just been shot. And I mean, on my life, my children's, I would have swore to you that it was, but I conflated those two because I used to love her, whatever. And I conflated those two things. And so, anyway, and I use that example because it's a meaningless example. It's not personal. It doesn't mean anything. It didn't affect my life. And yet, I was wrong. And I swore I was right. Anyway, I don't know if that has anything to do with anything. But
Yeah, well, they say neurologically, I think Oliver Sacks wrote that we remember in narrative, you know, that it's not just a bunch of ions going around, but that we remember our lives in narrative terms.
And we write a narrative to suit what we need to suit.
Actually, Renee came in with a text question. She asked, she's one of the people on Zoom, did you consult with your son when you're writing the story? Did you seek his input, or did you just say, look, buddy, here's the story and you have to live with it?
Well, I would love to have had his input, but my son he's actually off walking the Camino right now again for a second time. He's walking.
Wow.
Yeah. But I did. He wasn't, he couldn't be bothered for a while. And then, and he didn't even read the book till we read the audiobook together. And then he goes, Dad, that's not what happened. This is what happened. And you didn't put in the quote where James said this. That was so good. I'm like, oh my God, Sam, I asked you on that night if there was anything. And you were, you know, he was 19. He didn't give a shit. So he was not any help at all. But only in hindsight, he told me what I had wrong. And I'm like, well, it's too late now, isn't it?
That's funny. That's funny. David, did you have a question?
I did.
Yeah. So here's, David can go around the table and ask a question.
Forgive me. I'm not playing gotcha. But earlier you said acting, writing are both storytelling. Later you said it's the director who is the storyteller. And can you discuss that difference, what you mean by that?
Well, yeah. As a director, you're responsible for telling the story. In acting, you're still telling the story, but you're just inhabiting a facet of it. So you're just inhabiting certain aspects of it. So you're involved in story. You're just not responsible for telling it, I guess is what I mean by that. You know, whereas a director, you're responsible for like keeping your eye on, oh, is the story being told here? Or is this just a wonderful moment for its own sake? And can the story tolerate it? Usually my answer would be no. If it's just for its own sake, then it goes. You know, that kill your darlings thing. But so that would be all, you know. But the acting really helped in the storytelling, because in the acting, you are inhabiting, you know, so you can really paint pictures in a way and then put on your director hat suddenly and pull back and give it context, you know, which refers back to the kind of, in The Hook, you want to be the actor. I'm diving down underneath and I'm bursting up to get air because I can't breathe with this, because I've got this oyster, this pearl thing in my hand, you know. And so that is sort of the acting. You're inhabiting this moment and then you pull back and go, I'm in Tahiti, which is a bunch of islands, and I'm doing this. You know, so that's the director hat suddenly. And then you can, in moments, dive back in and be subjective again. And so we're constantly, you know, that kind of is how I would, if that makes any sense.
Any general tips on writing about, like, familial relationships, you know, versus...
Well, that's tricky, isn't it? Because you're not, you know, I would, oh, you know, when the first book I wrote was largely about coming to terms with getting, it was a travel book, but it was really about coming to terms with getting, how do we keep our inherent solitude and singularity and have intimacy with those we love? Which, because I was getting married again, and I was trying to reconcile those two things. So consequently, my wife was in it a great deal. And it's not about a tell-all about my wife. There are certain facets of my wife that are in it, whereas there are certain facets of my son that are in it. But like when Sam talks to me about being jealous, I don't talk about why he's jealous, what he's jealous of. I use that as a springboard to talk about my own jealousy. So he's being real, but it's really about, I don't feel like I have the right to, I'm not there to tell all and a judgment of my family. But it's a tricky one. It's a very tricky one. So I bounce it back to me. I'm the buffoon trying to figure out how to get married. My wife is this kind of amazing person, which she is, and I am. And so, but, you know, it's always, I use them as a bounce board to come back to talk about this fool. It's not for me to talk about them. That's not my right, or that's not really something the reader's going to, you know, if you're writing a Hollywood memoir and just want to tell a cool story about Rob Lowe, okay, that's fine. And if that's all you're, that doesn't really matter. But what I'm writing, mentioning Rob Lowe and the thing, because it, I felt like such an outsider, and he seemed like he really knew what was going on, but I felt like so insecure. That's what I'm writing about. Not about what he was like. He presented this way, and it made me, and I felt this way in reaction to it. So it's really back about me. He's there always, the springboard to bring it back to self. But, you know, I don't feel personally that I have the right or even interest, because I don't see them clearly. I only see them through the prism of my vision. I don't know what they're really like. I don't know what, you know, I don't know how you would experience them or how other people do. I don't know how I experience them. And that's not the truth. Like we were talking about before about truth. That's my experience of it, but that isn't wholesome. This is who it was. It's not like Vin Scalzo was on the radio, not Alison Steele. That's a fact. It's not a fact that my father was a certain way. That's how I experienced him. So it's about me. It's not talking about what an asshole or an angry person he was. I experienced it this way. But it's a tricky one for sure. It's a slippery slope. And you want to make sure, you know, in my experience, you want to, you know, you're not there to settle scores. I use it as an exploration of self, you know, that go back to the Joan Didion. I try to figure out what I'm feeling. What do I really feel? Oh, that's what I feel about that. Oh, I thought he was just angry and he was, but no, it's really bad. I didn't provide that. I didn't give that either. I was withholding. Huh. I didn't know that. And then I have forgiveness for myself and consequently for him too.
Were you tempted to settle scores narratively?
No, I don't think that's my particular, I mean, I answer that very quickly, but when you think about it, but I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't have any scores to settle with the people I've been writing about. I love all the people I'm writing about, you know? So, and in writing the memoir, Hollywood memoir, I knew it wasn't about, it was very internal. This is what I experienced. Because in that particular instance, there was a perception of what the Brat Pack was, which was this group of actors in the 80s that you're probably all too young for. But it was, as we were the, you know, catnip and had the world by the tail, which from the outside perspective, we did. From inside, my internal experience was very different. So I was interested in creating, sharing the internal experience of what it felt like. I wasn't interested in recreating what the exterior was.
Well, Andrew, I know you have to go on some hikes and maybe meet some more taxi drivers that you won't be able to quote. So I'm just curious if there's anything you can leave us with. I mean, everybody who is sort of taking their own narrative approach to travel stories, and they're also experiencing Paris in ways that I'm excited to learn about. What would you leave us with as travelers and writers, just in terms of advice or perspective about how to approach this vocation?
Oh, I just think with the more I'm interested in what I'm doing, the more I keep my eyes open and really stay curious, you know, and not think I know what the story is going to be, you know, be surprised, allow surprise to enter in to it. Like I said earlier about having the scaffolding and know what the story is, but you can also be within that context is great surprise. And details, details, details. I always think details tell everything, you know, moments, incidences. You can blow a lot of air into tiny incidences. You know, I did a story about Vienna once and I did this whole thing about the sort of the hook of the whole story became this waitress who brought me a cup of coffee once. And I just blew up this whole thing about this narrative about her and the coffee and sitting in this cafe. And it was a 5-second encounter. But there's something about it that just captured my time in Vienna. That instant captured my time. And so if you keep your eyes open for the instant that captures something, that's it, that's it, that's my trip, that's my trip. Then live in that.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about my travel memoir workshops each summer in Paris, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.